To make matters worse, my friend Yehuda's the waiter for tonight. Another friend Amy's here too. She just flat out insisted on coming. Strangers knowing I'm chubby isn't so bad. But friends learning the truth, that's a whole new kind of shame.
You know, and you'd see the level of commitment and rigour that he was reaching, and then he said to me, well, just as I'm getting good, they're going to kill me.
Those clips of people with Alzheimer's or dementia reacting to music from their childhood? These men and women at the mercy of their disease are almost completely withdrawn from their normal lives and disconnected from their families and loved ones. But when they're given headphones and played songs from their past, everything changes. Their faces light up, their bodies start moving, they laugh, they cry.
One to talk with all by myself, no one to walk with, but I'm happy on the shelf. A misbehaving, saving my love for you, for you, for you.
You're listening to All the Best. I'm Jess Hamilton, and this week we've got two stories about the therapeutic powers of art. Later on in the show, we'll be speaking to art teachers from the prison system about struggles they've faced and the unique experience of teaching inmates. But before we get to that, our first story comes from contributor Pip Leeson. You might remember him from a story we played earlier this year. In January, Pip tried to bring tantric sex into his life, but the experience left him scarred and embarrassed. This time, he's trying art as therapy, but it's not exactly him doing the art. In the vast public dialogue about body positivity, issues of men's body image rarely make their way to the surface. At least that's how Pip feels. In this piece, Pip embarks on his second challenge for 2017, to stand naked in a room full of strangers for an extended period of time. Grappling with weight gain and struggling body image, he finds himself nude modelling for a life drawing class, to test if others seeing him could change how he sees himself. Just a heads up, this story has strong language and nudity.
I come from one of those naked families, the ones that leave the shower with their towel tossed over their shoulder instead of wrapped around their waist. So I've never really had much of a problem with people seeing me naked. Get a drink or two in me and say,
"Oh, I bet you won't do it."
And off come the undies. So I've built quite a portfolio for public nudity, including the Martin Place Fountain at peak hour, the Chinatown Pedestrian Mall, and most of the parties I drank too much at in my teens. It was a surprisingly formative element of my self-discovery as a young adult, one that I'm equal parts ashamed and secretly kind of proud of. Sadly, my body positivity ends at genitalia. I was pretty overweight growing up, and my naked family are also kind of fat shamers. My dad would take the opportunity to tug on the rolls of my stomach with a raised eyebrow when I was shirtless, and whenever we pass a husky person on the street, he'll still whisper in awe-laden disgust,
"Oh, look at that one."
So it's fair to say I've developed some deep-seated body issues. I shed all the excess blubber in my teens and have remained consistently pretty gaunt through a healthy balance of binge dieting, appetite-suppressing cigarettes, intermittent bulimic spates, and long-distance running. Then, through overworking and studying full-time and relationship weight, I packed on a stack of kilos in 2016. Clocking into 2017, I didn't vow to exercise more or eat better as my resolution. Instead, I've tasked myself to complete monthly challenges in search of new experiences that keep me out of my comfort zone and all the other character-building buzzword bullshit. For February, my challenge is to model for a life drawing class, naked, of course. I figure it might be good for restoring confidence in my body or maybe encouraging me to get back into shape. And it just seems like something that every well-rounded adult has done at least once, right? So my friend Yehuda teed things up for me. He works at Parliament Cafe in Sydney, a cosy little spot where they host classes on Thursday nights. So here I sit, on a leather couch, wearing nothing but a San Francisco 69ers jersey. There are close to 20 people squished inside the tiny space, all facing in on me, and I'm acutely aware of the irony that though it's a life modelling class, I feel strangely dehumanised, like I'm a bowl of fruit or a classical instrument. Every now and again, someone will accidentally break the invisible wall and make eye contact with me, forced to let out a little wry smile. The classes are themed each week, and this week it's Andy Warhol. They're serving tomato soup and playing the Velvet Underground on vinyl. The timer starts, 1 minute poses begin, and off comes my jersey. Now, when you're inappropriately nude as a guy, you've sort of got all the power, in a gross penis privilege kind of way. It's as though the endowment has become a symbol of patriarchal prowess, which is routinely capitalised on and abused. Flashes, streakers, cock graffiti, unsolicited dick pics. The male anatomy has become desexualized, undesirable, and symbolically offensive. But here, in this moment, I'm not empowered or liberated or domineering. I'm helpless. I feel like all 20 pairs of eyes have just converged on my crotch. I mean, no one's looking directly at it, but when someone gets naked, you can't really help but notice. The first half of the class is short poses, all 1 to 2 minutes. In keeping with the Warhol theme, I've mussed my bleached hair up all jagged, and I've kept my acetate frame glasses on. I did pose research to prepare, and for my bold opening, I chose to mimic Warhol's Polaroid portrait of Arnold Schwarzenegger, in his prime, showing off his bronzed, burly, bulging bicep. Fucking sick start. With my beer gut, patchy chest hair, and weird, puffy nipples, I have chosen to emulate a photo of the man who was literally given the award for being the greatest physical specimen on Earth, Mr. Olympia. All of a sudden, I feel 8 years old again, twisting my torso and holding my breath on the starting blocks at the swimming carnival in an attempt to disguise my heft, trying to ignore the hooting crowd and wondering, well, why the fuck can't you wear a rash vest in a swimming race? Crouch. Hold. Twist. Flinch. Work the ankles. Work the ankles. Slight pout. Work the ankles. An hour in, we stop for a short recess, and I'm offered a beer. Oh, I don't care if it bloats me 1,000 times yes. I'm keen to take the edge off. To make matters worse, my friend Yehuda's the waiter for tonight. Another friend Amy's here too. She just flat out insisted on coming. And I've shattered the illusion of shapeliness I've maintained for them by usually wearing wildly oversized t-shirts. Strangers knowing I'm chubby isn't so bad, but friends learning the truth, that's a whole new kind of shame. With the beer down, I'm beginning to feel a little more confident, and I've started plotting different poses. The second half is longer ones, 10 to 15 minutes. How weird can I get? I ask.
Oh, totally go for it.
So when we reconvene, nothing left to lose, I try getting upside down. Arse in the air, I lay with my torso on the couch, my forearms and head resting on the ground, my legs dangling over my body. As soon as I adopt the position, I'm thinking, Jesus, what have I done? I can't hold this. But the clock started ticking, and I'm going to have to stay as still as possible for 10 minutes. My legs are shaking and I start to wonder whether this is a good workout. Maybe when I stand back up, I'll have cheese grater abs. I'm trying to focus on the music, but it's Venus in Furs. Classic Velvet Underground, sure, but a terrible workout tune. Right now, I need that spin class house mix.
Yeah, 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 push it out, push it out, yeah.
Keep it together,
yeah,
keep it together,
push
keep
it out.
Keep it together, keep it together.
60 more seconds.
Keep it together. Hold on.
Push it out. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hold on.
Yes. Yes.
Keep on pushing.
Oh, hold on. Hold on. Hold on. Well, that was a bad idea. For a more comfortable pose, next I sit on the couch with my legs tucked up to my chest and my head in my hands. I'm pretty chuffed with this one. It feels very expressive, like a tortured artistic soul.
Nice.
But yet again, I've underestimated just how long 10 minutes is when you have to sit perfectly still. After a few minutes, my legs, which were tastefully clamped together when I started, have gradually crept apart, and now I'm just spreading at everybody. It's very ungraceful. For safety's sake, I just lie on the couch for the last 15 minutes.
Okay, great. That's it. You can get dressed.
After we finish, I grab a wind-down beer and I spy some of the artworks. Smeared charcoal silhouettes, running watercolour figures and crumbly pastel penises. They're incredible. Not the penises, the artworks in general. But they're also not particularly flattering. Driving home, I'm hanging a cigarette out the window and thinking about what my brother told me when I was a chunky 14-year-old and he was one semester into his medical degree. Full of, I think I'm a doctor already, wisdom, he pointedly informed me,
"Do you know how unhealthy it is to be overweight? It's actually harder on your body than smoking."
I flick the cigarette. I can feel my stomach's bulging over the seatbelts. One or the other, Pip. You're fat or you smoke. You're doubling up. Fuck, I really need to start jogging. I recall the countless campaigns I've seen for women's body positivity blossom online. All about that base, curves are beautiful, lose hate, not weight. But I feel like I've never been told that it's okay for me to be a little bit chubs as a guy. I've never been told that it's okay to have anything other than a washboard stomach and biceps. Somehow, in amongst the countless myths of masculinity, we've decided that dudes can't feel bad about their bodies. We do. Then I remember the conversation I had with one of the artists during the break. He said that I had a good body to draw, with nice soft edges, and that I was very real. I guess that'll have to do. Embrace the dad bod.
That story was by Pip Leeson, with help from supervising producer Selena Shannon, as part of Pip's ongoing series, It Wasn't My Idea. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Jess Hamilton, and today we're looking at how art can help us to heal and to learn about ourselves and act as a kind of therapy when all else fails. The relationship between art teacher and student is unique. Whether it's leading a group in a life drawing class, helping one student spin clay on a pottery wheel, or a painting tutorial on YouTube, learning about art and creating it in a learning environment is generally a fun and safe experience. But behind prison walls, this relationship can be wildly different for both the teacher and the student. In 2015, Myuran Sukumaran was executed in Indonesia for his part in the Bali Nine drug smuggling ring. But in the last few years of his life, Myuran led a blossoming life as a painter within his prison cell. How much does teaching art to someone who faces such an impossible future affect both the art teacher and the student? This next story comes from Philippe Perez, who spoke to art teachers in prisons across Australia about their experiences.
In a prison system, you are in a world where things can be a little absent. You're someone doing time after you've broken the law. You're waiting to get out. The day is seemingly impossible to go through. If you're an educator in that system, it's another world that you need to get used to as well.
Just things like the language and the behaviours and, you know, the general way of life in that facility was definitely something that sort of initially shocked me. It was something that was overcome pretty quickly when you realised that a lot of these kids were just young boys a little bit lost. So once you got over that initial shock, it was nothing particularly surprised me after that.
That's Dan Wright. He spent 2 years working for the Parkville College at the Malmesbury Youth Justice Facility, 2 hours north of Melbourne. When he talked to me, he mentioned his difficulties teaching art in prisons were more to do with the physical equipment rather than the attitude of the inmates themselves.
So a lot of the equipment was deemed as to be a safety risk to some of the boys, or it had the potential to be used as a weapon. So those things were sort of vetted before they'd come in to the facility itself.
In the Northern Territory, actor and art teacher Adam Drake teaches creativity with youth in the Don Dale Detention Centre and for adults at Darwin's Holtz Correctional Centre. You may remember Don Dale was recently exposed in a Four Corners investigation that found mistreatment of young offenders and sparked a Royal Commission.
I love my job. I get paid to do what I love. I very rarely find challenges. I see situations like the Four Corners report that came out that was devastating to the space at Don Dale. I see one-sided media reports which affect morale of staff and of young people and the adults over at the Holtz Centre. And that's my biggest challenge, is the way that uninformed people want to comment on a space that they know nothing about.
Adam utilises a technique called hope theory, which was something he developed when he was being involved at a program at Don Dale called Counterpunch. The government got in contact with him to try and set him up with his own program, which he called Balanced Choice. This hope theory is combined with fitness and theatre games that aim to role-play situations to ease people back into life. Here's a typical day for him.
We do a check-in when we get in there, so just to check in with the kids to see where they're at and how they're feeling for the day. So, I've used that technique with all my theatre students over the years. We start stretching, we just get into the fitness. I use animal gymnastics and body weight exercises with the crew. Smash out an exercise routine that might go for half an hour to 40 minutes. After that, we will cool down, do a stretch. I provide the kids with a Powerade or a Gatorade. I bring out the quote of the day. We sit over the quote of the day and we talk about life, talk about choices, talk about hope and, where they're heading, set up some goals. I use a thing called the happiness wheel, which we look at the 8 different points in their life, set goals in those areas, and then we role play life. So we get up and we do some physical work around role playing situations that might become difficult, or job interviews or whatever it might be. So there's an actual practical outcome to the work.
For Dan Wright, while conversations are important, much like Adam explained, he also sees art as a passage to express yourself while a prisoner.
I think creativity gives them an opportunity or a forum to express themselves. It's a chance to express how they're feeling, what their thoughts are in a safe environment, an environment that they've previously recognised or acknowledged that they're comfortable in. And I think that's a massive thing within a prison system, is to allow that. It's probably more important in that regard than a conversation or writing their thoughts down. I mean, being able to express yourself in a creative manner is sort of, it's one of those outlets that that people really have taken up. I'm just very grateful for the experience or the opportunity to work in such an environment where you meet some incredibly resilient kids who happen to have made one or two silly mistakes throughout the course of their lives.
But there are always frustrating days.
Working in that facility, working in a facility such as that, is an incredibly polarising experience. I often say that some days you would walk out with one of the biggest smiles on your face, thinking you've actually made a difference in one young man's life, and then there'd be other days you'd walk out shaking your head, wondering why you even bothered. And I just think at the end of the day, that comes back to the nature of the place that you're in. And, it's equally as rewarding as it is sometimes frustrating too.
Nadine Sparks is a Melbourne-based performer, improviser, comedian and teacher. She was asked for a short stint to travel to Queensland to help out on a puppet play that inmates at Nunanbar Women's Prison were working on to take it to the next level. She undertook the project through performance exercises and conversations similar to Adam Drake's project. Nadine's views on getting people to get in touch with their creativity is hugely valuable.
Well, I think art advantages everyone who participates in it, and I think particularly people who have been, and I'm not saying everyone in prison's been marginalised, a lot of people have done quite horrific crimes and that's why they are in prison, but I actually believe that was going to sound Woodstock, but, you know, by feeding your spirit, by actually doing something positive, by expressing yourself in a positive way, there can be real reform via creativity.
For Adam, the benefits of his Balanced Choice program are in the pathways that are available outside of art.
The best way that I gauge where the crew are at is when they get out, how quickly they contact me and let me know that they're going well. And, you know, there's a young man that I've worked with who's now over in WA, and he's been involved in a university over there now and got himself heading down some pathways towards the law. And there's so many who contact me through emails and through Facebook. That, to me, yeah, is the greatest sign to see where these guys are at. I have others that go back in. They're still caught up in the recidivism of going back in and out of prison. And, you know, I talk about it as speed humps. There might be a few more speed humps on their road, but at the end of the day, we'll hit the open road soon and we won't be going back. And if I give up hope, then they'll have every reason to. So it's important that I don't.
These local instances of teachers heading to prisons, giving their time and expertise to those on the inside to become creative, instill hope and an inkling of chance to those who get out for a better life. But what if you were put up to teaching art to someone who doesn't have a life of freedom to look forward to?
Unprecedented security surrounding the two Australians as they left their Bali jail that's been their home for the better part of the last decade. And this is where they will spend their final days, the island of Nusa Kambangan, also known as Indonesia's Alcatraz. It's not clear when the executions will take place.
Mayuran Sukumaran and Andrew Chan have finally admitted their role in the Bali 9 drug run, but have come to court begging for their lives to be spared.
How are you feeling?
Yeah.
They were taken to a holding cell, their shackles removed. Both men were visited by their brothers.
How you doing?
Andrew Chan appeared first. They read their statements in Bahasa as their families watched on.
What you've just heard is audio from the BBC and Channel 9 covering the trial and execution of Mayuram Sukumaran and Andrew Chan. In 2005, Mayuram, who we'll call Mayu from here on in, was arrested in Bali with three other people in a hotel room. Police also found heroin in the room he was in when he was arrested. Mayu was taken to the court, where he was tried alongside eight others for attempting to smuggle the drugs into Australia. All nine members were known as the Bali Nine through various media. After an exhausting trial, Mayu and his co-defendant Andrew Chan were sentenced to be executed. Once Mayu was in prison, he took up painting, and it became a driving passion for him. Archibald Prize winner Ben Quilty and visual artist Matthew Sleeth mentored Mayu, travelling between home and Bali for 2 years, guiding him, making sure he was producing portraits of himself, other inmates, political figures and the occasional celebrity. They've become so revered that they currently hang in the Campbelltown Arts Centre in an exhibition called Another Day in Paradise. Up to 4,000 people attended the first week of the exhibition. He was also completing a fine art degree as part of a Charles Sturt University scheme. The Campbelltown Arts Centre Gallery is displaying over 100 of his pieces. They're full of thick paint, stark darkness, really inducing a mood of somberness. Here's Matthew Sleeth talking about a portrait Mayu painted of Andrew Chan, all within his prison cell.
All the body language as well, and so one of the things that's been amplified is a decision to keep glasses on and not being able to see that, and the way we normally read a personality is sort of denied in a way. And I think you can see, I can see an enormous amount of Andrew in his body language. I can see an enormous amount of Mayu in the way, you know, he's very alert and his eyes are sort of blinking, and Andrew's just very zen, and he's just really, it's only his breath that's moving him. And he's very calm, sort of staring directly, whereas Maya's a little bit more alert and there's a little bit more going on, and it's a, you can kind of see their personalities in that, and I think you can see their personalities in a decision to wear glasses as well.
Matthew Sleeth treated the situation much like any other guidance that he would give any other student of his.
He was just a mate. He was another artist that I hung out with, like, you know, like Ben or like anyone else that I spend time with, and we talked about all the things that artists, you know, you talk about what your peers are doing, you talk about the work you're making, that I'm making, that people we know are making. We talk about the people that have gone before us, you know. And so that idea of, you know, he was just another artist I hung out with.
Even though Mayu was a student here, Matthew learnt many lessons himself.
And, so I think that's the, you know, the lesson for me is just seeing him as another artist. And then the exhibition for me makes me think about, you know, my overwhelming feeling about this is about the art that's not going to be made now, mm-hmm. and the waste of it all. So, you know, when you see the level of commitment and rigour that he was reaching, and then realising that, you know, he said to me, well, just as I'm getting good, they're going to kill me. I think, you know, that passion to keep making art. And so it's the absence that I see.
Matthew also led art workshops with Mayu's other Karabakan inmates. He feels teaching art to those inside is a complex process, but it can be life-changing and politically motivating.
Absolutely. I mean, I think this exhibition as a whole serves as the perfect argument against the death penalty. You see the value of second chances, you see how people can change, you see the support that was necessary for that to happen from the prison. You know, so, and then you see the waste of that in a political execution. And so I think, you know, there's a lot, obviously, we can take from what not to do about that. And I'm disgusted at what happened in Indonesia. But I'm also think we can learn a lot about giving people second chances and the opportunity to rehabilitate from the way that the prison authorities in Karabakan allowed Andrew and Maya to become different people and supported them. You know, that's a long, slow, difficult process. It doesn't happen on your own. It doesn't happen without resources. And it doesn't happen without trust.
Matthew, along with Ben Quilty, found trust with Mayu to not see him as a drug smuggler, but to see him as a beautiful artist, producing beautiful works worthy of hanging in the Campbelltown Art Centre. Within the political processes of the Bali Nine, between the two countries of Australia and Indonesia, here was a story of rich creativity that unfortunately simply stopped.
That's the idea of the work, in a way. It's so easy to read something in a paper and someone to become a political abstraction or just a number or a word. And so to return that abstraction to actually what a human life is and what a person is and what a personality is, and being able to see their look in their eyes and see Maya's smile and Andrew, you know, is, you know, confronts our, you know, assumptions about how you can just write somebody off.
That story was by Philippe Perez, with special thanks to Lily Occhiuto. The exhibition, Another Day in Paradise, is on display until March 26th at Campbelltown Art Centre. We'll post the details on our website, allthebestradio.com. You can find out more about Adam Drake's Balanced Choice program at balancedchoice.org. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Selena Shannon. Our Victorian State Coordinator is Bethany Atkinson-Quinton. Our Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Tegan Nichols compiles our show. Beth Gibson is our SYN Production Manager. And I'm Jess Hamilton. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and also find our archives at allthebestradio.com. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.